Look at this. It's been such a big week, and not actually only for crypto. I mean, these are the altcoins. Every single bubble is green except for Monero, which is down 8.71%. It's been a great week for Bitcoin, but actually it's been the best week for the Chinese stock market, because I guess that a lot of what happened this week actually happened because of the China stock market. And what you can see is that the Chinese stock market is up 18.5% this week. So it's been a massive week. And that's triggered the rest of the markets to actually start running. And it seems like the train has actually left the station. So if you want to know what's going on, this is what the show is going to be about. The show is about showing you all the macro conditions that have set up for this massive run in China, which has obviously gone into all the other markets. I'm going to show you exactly what this run is about, but I'm also going to show you exactly when this run's going to end. And apparently this run doesn't end very well. So that's what the show is about. It's a much more macro show. So if you like macro and you want to know what's driving the market from a macro point of view, this is the show. Let's go, guys. Let me say this. If you're here and you are watching this and your portfolios are up after like 200 days of being down and being destroyed, you deserve it. We all deserve it, because the guys that stuck around are the guys that actually that we're going to make it. We're all going to make it. So listen, guys, if you are going to make it, what I need you guys to do is I need you guys to subscribe to this channel. Subscribe, join this. We think we're like 1,088,000 subscribers. I really want to get to 1.1 million subscribers. Got a very different show for you today. That's why it's coming to you on a Sunday. It was going to come to you on a Friday, but we made the best Solana conference video on Friday. So today we're doing the equivalent of the Friday banter. But today is all about macro. And the reason why it's all about macro is because the pumps in the markets, the pumps in the UK markets, the pumps in gold and the pumps in crypto and all risk assets this week actually came from China. And the reason why they actually came from China is because China is in trouble. And as a result of their trouble, they've gone into unprecedented stimulus. Now, when I say unprecedented stimulus, they've cut interest rates. They have announced a $140 billion injection into the market. They've even said, get this, that even after reducing the reserve requirements and everything else, what they've even said is that the People's Bank of China will actually loan investment houses money to buy the Chinese stock market up. That's exactly what's going on. So China's gone into extreme measures, and that's why the macro train seems to have left the station. Now, with the macro train leaving the station, it does mean that we're going to get a move in all of the risk assets, or that's what I thought at least. And apparently we may get a move for a while, but apparently after that, we're going to get one of the worst recessions that's out there. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. But before we do, I want to remind you of two things. Well, I want to remind you of three things. One is, look at this. It's been a good week, not only for China, but also for our friend Baked. My advice to you is start looking at Baked again. I'm going to make a big announcement around it next week. Also, remember that our Sunday banters today are actually brought to you by NordVPN. Now, generally, I wouldn't show you NordVPN on a Sunday, but this week was a big week. And the reason why it was a big week is I know that you use Telegram, because I use Telegram. And I know Hardass uses Telegram, and I know Josh uses Telegram. But I also know that the founder of Telegram was arrested. And after he came out of jail, and this is an announcement that Telegram made. If Telegram receives a valid order from the relevant judicial authorities that confirms you're a suspect in a case involving criminal activities that violate Telegram's terms of service, we will perform a legal analysis of the request and may disclose your IP address and your phone number to the relevant authorities. Now, we always relied on Telegram to be like the savior for free speech and protecting our rights. And now we realize that they arrested the founder, and then the founder chickened out and basically said, oh, you can have all the information. Why am I telling you this? Because you need to start being anonymous, because I know you guys are interacting with DeFi apps and crypto exchanges. I know you're not reporting everything like you should be reporting everything. I don't think you're a criminal. I just don't think everyone should know what the hell you're doing. There's actually only one way to hide your IP address properly, and that is to use a VPN. Now, when I say use a VPN, you can use a normal VPN. Go ahead, be my guest. But if you use NordVPN, you have a thing called a double VPN. There it is. Which means that you're getting a VPN on a VPN. Which means that the hackers and the governments and that really, really, really can't find you, because it's like your address is a VPN on a VPN. And they've got a mobile application and they've got a desktop application. I can't stress this enough. If you're in crypto, you need to be protecting your IP address. If you want to protect your IP address, you take this deal, which is available, by the way. If you want to know where it's available, it's here. It's here in the description. There's a link for the VPN. Take the VPN. Pay $3.99 a month. $2.99 a month. Hide your identity so that one day your IP address doesn't land up in the hands of the authorities or in the hands of hackers. Okay, so it seems like the train has left the station. And as one of my guests says, actually, she says, the funny thing about the nothing stops this train meme is how long it goes on for everyone. The deficits will be big. The consequences will be profound. And yet little will change this decade except around the margins. Strap in. So let's get the guests on. Lynn, welcome. George, welcome. Lynn, before we get started, tell me a little bit more about the train and the station and what you're referring to here.
Yeah, so my meme there is about the structural deficits that are going to continue for quite a while in the United States with very little probability that it would change within any sort of investable time horizon. And people, you know, when the private sector runs into a credit event or a solvency event, it's disinflationary, it's death by ice. Whereas when a sovereign runs into a solvency event, it's generally death by fire. And especially in the US's case, I think it's a really long runway for how that plays out, because basically they can control the denominator. They can, if you know, kind of like how we saw in the UK when their bond market had a problem, they could go to temporary QE to put out the fire, and then when they put out the fire, they go back to not doing QE anymore. And I think that we're going to see a similar thing in the US, which is that if the bond market's fine, it just kind of keeps going. If it runs into an issue, they can deal with it like they dealt with it in 2019 and 2020 and elsewhere. And I think that this is a background reality that exists in markets now, this kind of structural 7% of GDP deficits, very high nominal growing deficits in a world where interest expense exceeds U.S. military spending. And that this is a background phenomenon now. When you look at emerging markets, it's obviously more extreme context, but generally speaking, when they run into issues, their asset prices stay elevated more than you think in local currency terms. They don't do well in gold terms. They don't do well in dollar terms, but they generally, have a bid in local currency terms just because the denominator itself is what's weak. And I think that developed markets are kind of going through a lighter version of that, a less extreme version of that, which is that things stay more bid than people think, largely because the denominator is what's going down gradually over time.
Yeah, is that not because probably the dollar is not a great place to be, but it's still safer than being in the South African rand or the Argentinian currency or whatever it is? Is that not just being the the way I see it, no country or no denominator is perfect, but the dollar is probably a little bit better than most others, right? And so the denominator.
I would say most others. There are some countries that have kind of structural current account surpluses, and that they generally have the option of having their currency appreciate versus the dollar. They generally choose not to. They, like the Switzerlands of the world, keep their currency suppressed to try to avoid their currencies appreciating versus the dollar. But yeah, the majority of currencies are kind of in a structural loss versus the dollar.
And goods and services too. I mean, it's important to point out for the last 12 years that the dollar is appreciated against goods and services in many countries. I would say most countries.
Yeah.
As an example, if you look at Japan, if you look at the inflation rate compounded in Japan and you look at the appreciation of the appreciation of the dollar relative to the yen exceeds the compounded inflation rate. So okay. This is the same for Brazil, Malaysia, India, a lot of major economies. So it's no wonder that the dollar is not just the preferred currency, but in a lot of places, the preferred asset.
Were you guys as surprised as I was last week when the Fed dropped rates by 50 basis points? Was that on your bingo card that the Fed would actually drop rates by 50 bips? I must say I got caught completely by surprise there. I did see the probabilities going up leading into the Fed rate cut. But what do you think the logic was of reducing rates so quickly as opposed to doing a gradual rate cut decrease, going 25, waiting a little bit, going 25 again, waiting a little bit? Why do you think they came out the gates with a, let's call it a double rate cut?
Because the economy is headed for a recession. They see the inversion of the curve. They see the bull steepener. They see the SOM rule. They see unemployment spike. And they see that the probabilities, although not 100%, are leaning towards a hard landing. And so they've got to try to get in front of that.
And I mean,
I agree.
Go ahead, Lynn.
I was gonna, yeah, when you go down from 9% to 3%, inflation as officially measured, and as you see unemployment go from 3.4% to 4.2% as officially measured, their balance of risks has changed toward that employment side. And they view themselves as basically wanting to get back toward a more neutral policy, if not eventually a more dovish policy.
Yeah, and so, the 2-year treasury, I mean, let's not forget the fact they usually follow the 2-year. And when you got the 2-year, I forgot what it was before they cut, but it was right around what, Lynn, maybe 3.7, something like that. So you've got just a massive delta between Fed funds and the 2-year. And Jerome Powell is an idiot. You know, he looks at the same charts that Gundlach looks at. Gundlach always talks about how the Fed follows the 2-year. So when you combine that with everything else, I think, and then also too, I don't think it shocked the markets to the extent that it was almost a 50-50 probability going into the Fed decision. So
how do you see the rest of the upcoming rate cuts? Do you think that the Fed's going to adopt a much more aggressive approach and maybe reduce again by 0.5, or, you know, I think there's 2 meetings left this year. Do you see the Fed going quite aggressively into rate cuts, or do you think that they're going to, they've come out the gate to the 50 and then they're going to kind of slow it down, maybe miss a meeting, maybe not wait. How long is it going to take for the effects of the rate cut to actually filter into the market and for them to make a decision as to whether they should be reducing quicker or slower?
Well, they've never prevented a recession. They've never prevented a hard landing. When you look at a rate hiking cycle, going back, let's just say, to early 1990s, the only one that I can see that didn't result in a recession was 95. And in 95, you didn't have the issue with the unemployment rate, which is huge, and you didn't have an inversion of the curve, along with many other factors. So my point there is every single time they have a rate hiking cycle, they have a rate cutting cycle that isn't gradual. I did a video the other day where I use the example of wet and wild. That's what their rate cutting cycle usually looks like. So I don't know why it'd be any different this time.
Lynn, what do you think? Are you in the same camp? Do you think that there's going to be a hard landing, a recession, aggressive rate cutting cycle? I mean, in recent rate cutting cycles, I think I'll agree with you, but I think the further back you go, the more you find cases of, 2001 and 2007, 2008, those were very fast rate cuts. But before that, they were a bit slower, right?
Yeah, I think they're going to, the rate that they're going to cut is dependent on how fast some of this deteriorates. If it holds on stronger than people expect, I think they'll go with these 25 basis point cuts. If we get some sort of dislocations, they'll go with these bigger rate cuts. That's how they've always behaved. One of the kind of unusual aspects of this cycle is that large fiscal component. It's unusual to run 7% GDP deficits before a recession even begins. You're kind of pre-stimulating. And so what we've actually seen in the markets, if you look at 2022, a lot of signs of recession are there despite not being an unemployment cycle. So for example, if you look at the misery index, which is unemployment plus inflation, that reached recessionary levels. If you look at consumer sentiment, that reached recessionary levels. And then interesting, if you look at private sector credit, that also reached recessionary levels in the sense that if you look at, for example, senior loan officer surveys, you know, are they tightening credit or are they loosening credit? They hit this kind of spike period of like 40% of them were like tightening credit, and it was rising. And, you know, historically, whenever you reach those levels and sustain it, that gives you a recession, you know, going back to the 90s. And we tighten into that. And then they actually started loosening out of that. They started tightening at a lower rate, which is evidence of historically going out of a recession, that you've emerged from a recession. So we kind of went through this like private sector credit recession in a sense, without credit losses and without an unemployment cycle. And I think that's kind of what makes this cycle weird. So I do think that we're headed toward economic softness. I think we're headed toward weaker employment situation, but I'm not sure that we're going to have a big credit event because we have this kind of pre-stimulating background context, and we have a already went through a credit tightening cycle for something like 2 years. And so I think that most of the indicators that we have over the past 40 years, we're in an era of monetary dominance, so monetary policy and private credit cycles. And now I think we're more in fiscal dominance, which is that you basically add a little bit of emerging markets into the way the U.S. operates, and that things kind of run hot, even as they in real terms can suffer. So I think that we're going through economic softness, but I think it looks different than recent recessions.
So I mean, would you call this? Would you say that the Fed's engineered a soft landing so far? Would you say that it looks like the Fed has achieved what it called a soft landing? Or because it hasn't felt like a very hard landing, I'll be honest, at this stage. But it could be that the worst is actually yet to come. And so where it feels like it's all fine now, in a couple of months we'll realize that the landing is actually very, very hard. How do you feel about it? Do you think that this has been a soft landing?
So I've described it as an emerging market landing. Like, I mean, for the past year, whenever people ask me if we're going to get a hard landing or a soft landing, I say we're going to get an emerging market landing, I think, which is that it's kind of a soft landing, but it's because you're pre-stimulating. And when you look, there's kind of two ways to have a recession. And again, these kind of break down between what is a typical developed market recession versus an emerging market recession. So in a developed market recession, a small number of people have a really bad time. They lose their jobs. Most people are unaffected, and they're just nervous about job losses, or maybe they get a smaller raise that year. So it's like that the pain is kind of more localized. And then the other way to do it is that everybody gets a pay cut, or, you know, most people get a pay cut in real terms. And that's what you generally see in emerging markets. Like, you know, when I spend every summer in Egypt, for example, and people there are worse off than they were 2 years ago. And it's not because they lost their jobs. It's because they have worse purchasing power for real, like, high quality things than they used to have. And it's because it's the currency's kind of been rug pulled under them. And I think that people have kind of gone through that in the U.S. To a lower degree in the past few years, which is that a lot of people are you know, mildly worse off, rather than a handful of people losing their jobs and going through that cycle. So I think that basically there's different levers you can pull that affect what a recession looks like, even though you can't affect necessarily the real impact of, are more people better or worse off? I think we've kind of spread out the pain through that debasement.
George, what do you think? I mean, you mentioned the hard landing. So I guess that you're more of the opinion that there's a hard landing still to come.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at past cycles, you see the way they usually progress, and this cycle is the exact same.
And tell me why. What are you looking at?
Well, first you have an inversion of the curve, then you have a bull steepener, then what you have is the unemployment rate spike. And then you have an uninversion of the curve, and then the Fed drops rates, and then the stuff hits the fan. And then a year later, the NBER comes out and announces that, oh, by the way, we're in a recession. So if you look at that checklist, we're just check one, check two, check three. it's following literally the exact same timeline. So I think Lynn, though, makes a fantastic point that if there is, I think the best argument for, although it's not my base case, but the best argument for a softer landing would definitely be fiscal. And I went back and I looked at this for a video the other day. And if my memory serves me well, 2007, we were running about a 3% deficit as a percent of GDP. Now it's right around maybe 5 or 6. And you say, well, that's only 3%. It doesn't sound like that big of a deal. But I did the math and it was roughly $800 billion. So that's real money, you know, at the end of the day. So I think that, again, although it's not my base case, I think that's a really good argument and something to consider. But I would also point out in terms of the CPI that right now we're at 2.5%. And I totally, totally agree it's understated. But what we really have to look at is the trend. We have to look at the trend. And I think that's accurate as far as disinflation. And when you look at the real-time data, or something like rent, as an example, and you bake that into the cake, the CPI would be sub 2 right now.
It does, yes. I guess the CPI is overstated. That would mean the CPI is overstated, right, at 2.5%. Because trueflation estimates the CPI at like 1.1 something percent. So you got the official readings at like 2.5%, trueflation at about 1.5, 1.8%. So you think that that's overstated or understated?
Well, using their formulas, I should say, it's understated. I think, or excuse me, overstated. But in reality, it's probably, 4, 5, 6%, maybe plus. But what we have to look at is we have to look at that headline number, because that's what's going to impact markets to the most significant degree. And that's what's going to impact the Fed rate cutting or hiking or pausing decision.
So, I mean, it feels like we're going into a period of stimulation again. I must say, I'm on the side that the Fed acted probably just in time and maybe just one meeting too late. Like, I think if I was sitting in Jerome Powell's shoes, I probably would have started one meeting earlier. I mean, but he did a double rate cut now, almost like a reaction. It does feel though that we're going into a much more looser monetary policy period. A period of increasing M2 money supply, etc. How would you be positioned in terms of risk assets now? Would you be putting more money into risk assets?
Going into a period of increased M2. I mean, M2 has been down since 2022, and more recently it's been flat. I think it's ticked up slightly, but until we get that fiscal component that Lynn is referring to, and until the Fed goes from QT back to QE. I don't know that you're going to get an increase in M2, because right now, if you look at the banks, I mean, it's all risk off. I mean, that's one of the reasons why you have the curve inverted to begin with. But then you look at what's happening overseas in Japan. You look at what's happening with commercial real estate. And I don't, if I'm a bank, I'm not lending. That's for damn sure. I'm buying treasuries. So based on what we've seen since 2022, I don't think you're going to have a big spike or an increase in M2 until we get what Lynn's talking about.
Lynn, what do you think?
I agree. I would point out that money supply bottomed in 2023 and has been slowly grinding up, partially because we have kind of the Treasury offsetting the Fed. Active Treasury issuance is how some economists like Nouriel Roubini have described it. Basically, the shortening of kind of the issuance of extra T-bills, the draining of their reverse repos. So when you kind of take a more aggregate picture of both the Fed balance sheet and then these other components that are out there, the TGA and the reverse repo facility, we've kind of been in this flat liquidity environment ever since the, let's call it, the regional bank crisis of 2023. That was kind of a pain point. We started kind of going sideways rather than down after that. I expect that to probably continue until we reach the end of the reverse repo facility. And then the Fed already projects that by the end of 2025, they would probably go back to gradual balance sheet increases, not for stimulus purpose, but kind of like they did in 2019 with the reverse repo spike that they went through. They would basically say that we've reached the bottom of ample bank reserves. We want to start going up in bank reserves and maintain ample bank reserves. I think that's the language that they're going to use to frame it. And I think that we're kind of entering that period of money supply is going up, but not particularly fast. And that probably lasts.
You got to consider the banks too, because that in and of itself, to your point, would definitely increase M2 if they're buying from non-banks. But if the rate to which the banks are lending is decreasing more significantly, then it's still going to go down. So it's definitely, you got to take a holistic view, I think, is my point.
Yeah, and the bank lending component's a big deal, and that to my what I talked about before is that we went through this kind of tight cycle where, if you look at senior loan officer surveys, most banks were very conservative. They were basically saying we're tightening all of our standards, and now they're tightening less than they were a year or kind of 2 years ago. We kind of went this kind of 2022, 2023 cycle. They went through this tightening cycle. There's actually evidence that they're loosening up a little bit. And that's why we have these kind of weird components. Like, in some metrics say we're headed toward a recession. Other ones are saying we literally just had a recession and we're merging out of it. And it's because you have this kind of divergence between fiscal and monetary policy and this private sector versus public sector situation. Even if you look at asset positioning, for example, Costco is trading at like 55 or 56 times earnings, right? People are not piling into the ARK stocks. They're not piling into Bitcoin. They're not piling into small caps. Most of the kind of the enthusiasm in the market is actually toward fairly defensive things. These
blue they're chips. Selling Louis Vuitton and they're buying Walmart.
Yeah, they're but yeah, Walmart's going vertical, Costco's going vertical.
Yeah, but growth is not going vertical. Positioned. Yeah, but growth is not. I mean, as you say,
growth isn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think my point is that basically we already in some ways are positioned like a recession. The credit cycle we kind of went through and the positioning in these kind of defensive assets.
So I have a question. I mean, I saw this chart over here, which is the money, total money in money market funds. And you can see that total money in market money funds is about $6.5 trillion. What happens to all this money in a rate cut cycle? So you start cutting rates. The Fed cuts rates pretty aggressively. They start at the 0.5. Where does all this money go? Because, I mean, it's great to put your money into money market funds when you're earning 5.5, whatever the percentage rate is. But at twos and ones and threes, it doesn't really look that attractive. Where does this money go?
Where did it go in past recessions?
I'm asking you.
Well, it looks like it went down quite substantially. Definitely didn't go into stocks. It didn't go into housing.
So where does it go?
That's for sure. Stocks. I mean, in 2001, we had a balance sheet recession. So it definitely didn't go into stocks there. I think you go under it and you go into a recession, it's going to go into treasuries.
Lynn, what do you think?
Gold treasuries, probably.
Well, a lot of that's already in treasuries. When you look at what money market funds hold, they hold T-bills, they hold really short-term, high-quality commercial paper, and then they hold reverse repos, which are practically like treasuries. These kind of this like nominally risk-free yield. There's kind of a ratio issue right now between big banks and money markets. So if you hold your money in Bank of America, you're getting paid roughly something that rounds to zero in interest the top 10 banks have like half of the deposits out there. There's like 4,000 banks, but like half the deposits are in the top 10.
Lowest interest rates.
Yeah, and they're the ones that are not paying anything because they have no risk of a bank run or very minimal risk of a bank run, whereas like the credit unions of the world are the ones paying you 3% and 4%. And so if you're a customer at these banks, you say, well, you know, I got to have some money in my checking account for liquidity, but I'm going to put the rest in money markets and things like that. And that's why there's this flood into this. And this is already basically treasury or treasury-like assets. It's already in there. I think that's actually another sign of kind of people going through recession, which is basically people saying, I want to own these kind of conservative things. I think that what happens when rates go down is probably that modulates a bit, which is that you have a smaller delta between, you know, what Bank of America pays you and what money markets pay you. And some of that can drain back into the Bank of America's of the world, or at least there's fewer people clamoring to get out of the Bank of America's into these money markets. And so you get a little bit of a reabsorption, I think, into banks.
Or my point was they go out of the money market fund. I guess it would depend on the rate that they're paying you, right, at the end of the day. But I don't think that they take it out of the money market fund and then take it and go straight into the stock market if you've got a recession, unless the Fed's buying stocks. I mean, they could pull the BOJ type of deal.
BOJ or the China. Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I don't know if it's not only BOJ. I mean, this week we also had China doing exactly that. I mean, they cut rates by quite aggressively, but they also said there was allows brokers to tap Bank of Japan funding, Bank of China funding to buy stocks. Which is effectively China buying up its own stock market. How scary is the situation in China? Like, how much of an impact is this Chinese situation going to have? A lot of people were celebrating that, you know, the Bank of China starting to stimulate, starting to cut. They lowered the mortgage rates. They lowered the reserve ratios. Is this China starting to mass stimulate or not yet?
I think China's in the exact same position as Europe. And I think that I don't know how you go into a global recession without the United States playing ball, but more specifically with China. I don't know, you know, I don't follow China probably as well as Lynn does, but my guess is they've done a lot of stimulus packages in the past and it hasn't worked. And the fact that they're doing this tells you everything that you need to know about the underlying fundamentals of their economy. And I don't think it'll work.
So I've been paying pretty close attention to Chinese market because I think it's one of the bigger impacts on. I think too many people are focused on the Fed, not enough people are focused on China. in aggregate. And I think a key difference between China and Europe is that China controls its own central bank, right? So France can't tell the ECB what to do, but China can tell, China's central bank what to do. And it's, you know, it's the biggest physical economy in the world. So the biggest, you know, kind of steel producer and biggest trade partner in most countries. And, you know, this kind of the raw size of the non-financialized economy. So they're going through something like what we went through post GFC. So they're going through a big real estate valuation and leverage, you know, disinflationary kind of implosion, which they're kind of controlling because a lot of it's denominated in their own currency. And they have some competing goals. One is they want to internationalize their bond market. They want to have more of their trading partners willing to hold their bonds in their reserves, knowing that they can trade them back for goods and services from China in the future. It's kind of their ongoing, you know, slow motion de-dollarization that they're trying to go through. So they want to project that austere component. And then culturally, they're just less, both that and then culturally, they're less willing to just like stimulate, just throw out fiscal money everywhere. But the point I've been kind of watching is that they're near a pain point, which is when you have equities down this much, when you have real estate down this much, social media chatter in China is getting more negative. And they had their multi-year zero COVID policy, and then you got this like broad protests against it, which is pretty rare in China. And the administration pivoted. They basically their risk reward pivoted toward, okay, clearly we're going to get out of this now. And then they opened up, and zero COVID was never a thing. And then they're back to opening. And what you're seeing now is that there's increasing dissatisfaction in China around the economy, around the state of asset prices, around the government's own 5% GDP target. And I think that they're perceiving that the pain points are kind of moving toward. Draw a line under what's happening now. My base case is that nominally, we're probably seeing kind of the bottom of some of these Chinese assets. And we're probably entering a more bullish cycle. But it's them managing trade-offs. It's not like a solution. It's a trade-off. They can basically, they can deleverage some of their private sector, which is what they're trying to do, or they can decide that we've hit a pain point and we want to stimulate out of it. The biggest lever would be fiscal, right? So monetary can only do so much. It can, you know, especially with the way they're doing it, they can buoy stock prices, kind of draw a line under those. But I think the economy is probably going to languish for a little bit more, unless or until they decide to pull out some of these bigger fiscal guns.
I think their bond market, Lynn, correct me if I'm wrong, is pointing in the direction that stimulus will not work. I mean, I think their 10-year government bond is trading, 40 or 50 basis points under. It's the lowest it's ever been before. So it's not only at the low, but it's 40 basis points lower than the previous low. And I think that's also with the PBOC selling their debt into the market to try to get those interest rates up to have less of that recession depression signal.
Yeah, I think, if you look at the U.S. bond market in 2020 and 2021, the bond market was saying none of this fiscal is going to be inflationary, none of it's going to work, and the bond market just got rolled over. So I'm a little bit less – I take the bond market signals a little bit with a grain of salt. But basically, there's clearly still a very risk-off perception of China. There's not a lot of foreign investors want to go out and buy Chinese assets, partially because they're worried about China's economy – and partially because they don't want to happen to them what happened in Russia, which is that the companies continue to persist, but your American claims get null and void because there's some sort of geopolitical conflict that goes above the company itself.
That's a good summary of the risks. What about Japan? I mean, there was the cash and carry trade the reverse cash and carry trade that everybody spoke about. Then the Bank of Japan said, look, we're not going to increase rates anymore because we spooked the market. I mean, what happens in Japan? Do they just carry on with rampant inflation, or do we think that they've calmed the markets for now, and then they're going to just raise by another, you know, start raising again, maybe a little bit later in the cycle? Then what do you think?
I don't know how it plays out, honestly, but I had a conversation with Brent, and Brent did a deep dive in his newsletter the other day, and we've never seen a carry trade play out in 1 week. It usually takes quite some time. So his bottom line was, you probably haven't seen the last of the issues with the yen carry trade. As far as the government intervention there into the currency market to try to strengthen the yen, that doesn't seem like it usually works. But we'll have to find out. And I don't know that their inflation rate's that high. I guess it's high for Japan. Maybe 2%.
It's just relatively high. It's not, I mean, it's not high relative to the US or to South Africa or whatever, but for them, those kind of inflation rates are high. Len, what do you think? Is the reverse cash and carry?
I worry about the Japanese banks is more so, but anyway, go ahead, Len.
Yeah, I think that basically we saw kind of the fireworks component of it. It's one of those things, if you just kind of slept through that week, it's almost like it never happened, even though it was obviously a high volatility when it happened. I think that in many ways we're past the worst of it, in the sense that the worst part for Japan was when, so they're stuck in extreme fiscal dominance. They don't want to raise rates. The rest of the world's raising rates, and the differential kept growing and pressuring them. Now, as the rest of the world kind of goes back to periods of rate cuts, that actually takes some pressure off of Japan. And they're able to kind of continue their unusual policies with less pressure faced on them. I think that, we'll probably see little hiccups here and there, to the extent that that other one was a big hiccup. But my base case would be to take the under on any sort of fireworks scenario, and that I think that things are going to kind of continue on for years further.
I'd be concerned with the credit risk that those Japanese banks have on their balance sheet, because they had to go out the risk curve because of their dollar funding costs went up. You know what I mean? As an example, Norin Chukin, how they had those treasuries, they had to unload them at a $10 billion loss because the cost on the liability side of their balance sheet goes up because they have to roll over that dollar debt. So then what do? They go out and buy CLOs, where the underlying assets, commercial real estate in the United States. So my concern there in Japan.
I think it's funny. If you look at bank lending in Japan, it's very low. Obviously, they're not taking domestic credit risk. It's more in the type of assets they choose to hold. And I think probably we'll see more hiccups, but I think they'll probably just keep putting out the fires, because again, I think that these economies together are gradually weakening the denominator, and then we have these little pockets of implosions, but none of them are big enough to affect kind of the broad markets. That basically, like when commercial real estate blows up, it's like a $1 trillion problem for someone in a $900 trillion global economy. And so these little fireworks go off, and someone gets hurt. But then the broader sea of assets just kind of keeps chugging along in this dominant scenario.
So how would you be positioned now when it comes to risk assets? I mean, specifically, we're a crypto channel. A lot of people here are talking about crypto, but I think crypto is a function much more of how broader risk assets will play out. Or do you believe that it's not? Do you believe that Bitcoin is really not a function of risk assets? In fact, Lynn, I'd love to hear your view. Do you think that Bitcoin is going to behave like a risk asset, or is Bitcoin going to behave like a safe haven asset?
I think most pools of capital treat it as a risk-on asset. Obviously, there are people that are very enthused with the fundamentals, and then know that you can hold your own money and move around the world, and so it's got those risk-off properties. But in terms of pricing, most pools of capital treat it as a risk-on asset. I actually just so I worked with Sam Callahan. I commissioned a research report from him, and he wrote this report. It's on my website now, that maps Bitcoin to measures of global liquidity, and we found that Bitcoin's biggest correlation is with global liquidity, and it follows global liquidity better than any other asset. So better than stocks, better than gold. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is stocks obviously have other variables, things like earnings, that can impact their pure correlation with liquidity. Gold has, it doesn't have those earnings, but it does have some risk off aspects to it. So sometimes in a worsening liquidity environment, gold can actually catch a bid just because people want to get out of other things. Bitcoin has the highest correlation directionally with liquidity. I'm fairly bullish on liquidity with a 12-month view.
How is he defining liquidity? And I can't see the tweet. Oh, I can see the chart, but I can't see what you wrote.
So we there's a couple ways to do it. Michael Howe of Cross Border Capital has a more proprietary method of measuring global liquidity. We used global M2 that's denominated in dollars. And so basically there's two components there. One is the pace of credit creation. So the pace of more M2 units, broad money hitting the market. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is what is the dollar index relative to those? And the reason that's relevant is because so much, debts internationally are denominated in dollars. Mm-hmm. And so the dollar kind of weakening can make global liquidity go up in dollar terms, which are relevant relative to their leverage units.
Right. Okay, so it's done on M2, not M0.
Yeah. M2, broad. And so my base case is, you know, we've been in this consolidation. I think we're probably going to grind higher in the next 12 to 18 months in global M2. And I think, and when you look at various measures of valuation, I think that Bitcoin probably grinds higher in that time, is my kind of base case.
And what's your base case for NASDAQ/ tech stocks? And I use that as a proxy for growth stocks. What is your proxy the same, that they're a function of global liquidity? Or
yes, I'm a little more concerned about those because in addition to being correlated with liquidity, related to the state of the economy and their earnings and their revenues and consumer strength. So I do have concerns about the Teslas, the Apples of the world at their current valuations. And even NVIDIA, as much as I think that they're going to keep selling more and more GPUs, I think you can go through pockets of softness where a lot of entities bought all these GPUs that are not making money from them. And they can scale back their purchases for a period of time until they kind of figure out how their business model is going to work. I don't really have a high conviction view on these big tech stocks other than that I don't love the risk reward at these valuation levels and this kind of state of economic softening. And if anything, they're actually more treated like risk off assets, which is people say, I don't know what I want to own out there, but I don't want to own commercial real estate. I don't want to own cyclical things. So I want to buy Apple and I want to buy NVIDIA and I want to buy these big cash rich, you know, entities that are super profitable. And if anything, there's already a lot of capital stuffed into those, which concerns me.
George, what do you think? How do you see the proxy for risk assets and Bitcoin? Do you see Bitcoin correlated to NASDAQ, or do you see Bitcoin uncorrelated to NASDAQ?
In the past, it has been in the past. Moving forward, who knows? Honestly, I think if I had to throw out a guess, I would say it depends on if we do have a recession. Let's assume that we have one. It depends how it plays out. If it plays out like 2001, where we don't have like a huge liquidity event, then I think that would probably be bullish for gold and Bitcoin. Gold really didn't do much back then. But you notice if we have an event like 2007, then gold really sells off. And so, I would expect Bitcoin to do something similar until they plug that liquidity hole, and then gold rips. And then I would assume Bitcoin to do the exact same thing.
So let me ask you both the question. If you're uninvested and you're sitting on a pile of cash now, what do you do now as the dream case portfolio? And I'm not talking about specifics, obviously, in terms of which stocks, but I'm saying, how do you position yourself at this stage of the cycle? If you're sitting on a pile of cash that you need to invest, what do you do? What's the optimal investment strategy now? Do you sit in cash? Do you go into T-bills and ride a T-bill cycle, a declining T-bill cycle? Do you put your money into gold? How do you build a portfolio for this kind of environment that you guys are expecting? Lynn, maybe I'll start with you because just to give George some more time.
So I've been using the three pillar portfolio, which is one pillar is you know, equities. Another pillar is cash equivalents, things that are, you know, kind of protect you in one of those like liquidity risk off cycles. And then the other pillar is commodity producers and sound money that can do well in debasement and inflation cycles. So you have this kind of protection from different scenarios. You know, my base, and to George's point, I think it largely depends on whether we get a liquidity pocket or not. My base case is that we've probably already seen a liquidity pocket and that I kind of view this more like that 2001 cycle. But you can only be so sure about that type of outlook. And so I think that we a lot of these other assets probably over time grind sideways to up in this scenario. And if we do get a recession, I would think that, you know, in any sort of liquidity pocket, most assets go down. And if you don't get a liquidity pocket, then I think that basically things with earnings struggle, whereas things that don't have earnings, like gold and Bitcoin, that are more like responsive to liquidity, they probably do pretty well.
So how do you position yourself? Yeah. What how do you break down? I mean, let's just take a $1 million portfolio. How do you break it down? Where do you put the money?
So I mean, it depends on your risk tolerance. I put a lot of it in equities, a good chunk in gold and Bitcoin, a decent chunk in that kind of energy producer category, and then a smaller chunk in cash equivalents, things like short-term treasuries, money markets, T-bills.
What percentage?
Tips, short-term tips.
What percentage, under the fact that you're, you know, relatively risk, that you wouldn't take relative risks at the moment, what percentage would you be invested? What percentage would you be in cash and cash equivalents?
So for me, I have something like 15 to 20% in those cash equivalents. If I was obviously near retirement, I'd probably dial that up to some extent. But this comes down to whether or not someone's a high turnover trading portfolio or a more strategic evergreen portfolio. Mine is more evergreen, so I only make small marginal adjustments. I lean a little bit toward risk, or I lean a little bit toward risk off, rather than making these big sweeping changes about what I expect to occur over, say, the next 12 months.
George, what do you think? If you're investing $1 million today and that was your only investable income and you're not close to retirement, you're still in the accumulation phase of your life, where would you put the money?
Well, I think I'm a little more leaning towards disinflation than Lynn, just maybe by a little bit, just because I look at past recessions and even the 1970s, they're all disinflationary. So that being said, I definitely want to have gold for sure. I want to have 10% gold. That's just a given, especially the way gold looks, the price action, the chart looks really good, really good. And then I probably want to have 80% in T-bills.
80% in T-bills.
Absolutely. Yep. And then I want to have 10% in probably speculative assets. I'd have uranium. I'd have Bitcoin. And then I would definitely have call options on the TLT.
And why would you put why would you put the call options on the TLT? What's the thesis there?
That you're going to get a hard landing, and that when you do in past cycles, the long end of the curve goes down, and it goes down a lot. And I think, you know, what it's priced in right now is for the Fed to continue to go down on rates of the front end of the curve going down while the long end of the curve goes up, getting more of kind of like a bear steepener. And I just don't see any evidence in history, even look at the 1970s. You know, in fact, this morning I looked at M2 from 1970 to 1974, because that recession you had in 74 where the unemployment rate spiked, you know, that was followed by disinflation. It started with 11%. I think it went down to maybe 4%, but serious disinflation. And the M2 money supply from 70 to 74 went up by 50%.
So, I mean, the reason I'm smiling is because I actually put in a trade very similar to that earlier. So I have the TLT chart open on my desktop. I literally put in a trade it's the just in case trade, if you want to call it that,
on the TLT. Yeah, I think that's a good way to frame. And the upside's huge. I mean, upside is massive on that. And if you look at the asymmetry, I mean, that's at the end of the day, that's what investing is all about, right? It's not being right all the time. It's simply risk management. It's simply having an edge. And then placing asymmetric bets.
Mm.
And so I think that has a lot of asymmetry when you look at all the factors in the past cycles.
So guys, we are running out of time. George, I do see behind you, check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. It's been intriguing me the whole time. Maybe just a quick thing about what is georgegammon.com/pro. What is Rebel Capitalist Pro?
Well, what makes Rebel Capitalist Pro great?
What is it? What is it? Yeah, is it? And what are people signing up for?
Well, it's a membership site. It's a monthly membership site where we talk about investing and macro. And I was going to say one of the things that makes it great, or probably the greatest thing about it, is that it includes my business partner, Miss Lynn Alden. So it's you go there. It's a monthly membership, and it's live streams with people like Lynn, Brent Johnson, Chris McIntosh, myself. It's got some of her research in there. It's got an online forum, and it's just a really neat tool, I think, for investors to have that edge that we were talking about.
Amazing. So guys, what we'll do is we'll put a link below for anyone who wants to check it out. We'll put a link below. If you guys want to go and check it out, please do. Guys, I must thank you. We're out of time, but it's been amazing hearing your views, hearing the macro views. Very different from what we're used to. Usually, you know, we have very DGEN crypto-centric views. It's nice to bring it back down to earth and give us the much bigger picture. So much love to you guys. Thank you so much. And of course, we'd love to have you back. Trade well, my friends.